recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
Rory, listen to that.
What? All I can hear is silence.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Well, hi, folks. I'm Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone. Oh, this is great. And I'm here with my delightful co-hosts, Bobby Neer, Robert, and Dave.
Bartender, I'll take a whiskey straight up.
Are we having a great time? Yes.
Steak? 17 cents? Ridiculous.
Back in the 1800s. And I'm here with my wonderful co-hosts, and I love this. I love this. Well, we're going to get right to it today because it's rather unique. I guess that's as good a word as any.
Good word to put.
Oh, the best we can do. Unique Twilight Zone episode called Once Upon a Time. And Robert, darling, you will provide the opening clip, won't you?
Yes, I certainly will.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Mr. Mulligan, a rather dour critic of his times, is shortly to discover the import of that old phrase, out of the frying pan, into the fire. Said fire burning brightly at all times in the Twilight Zone.
Well, thank you so much for that. And, well, okay, what we have here, Woodrow Mulligan. That's the name of the main character. And he's a grumpy janitor, very grumpy janitor. He's living in the year 1890. And he's not satisfied with his time or his place. He lives in a quaint little town. I guess it's not a city. It's a little town.
Harmony, isn't it?
Harmony.
Yeah.
And they have 17 set cuts of meat. You get a steak. You get a steak there for 17 cents a pound. Oh, isn't that wonderful? And $2 hats, and the livestock, the lambs and the sheep, or I guess the sheep and the goats, and they're roaming in the streets, and the bicycles, they knock them down while they're going 8 miles an hour, because 8 miles an hour is the speed limit. And of course, he works for Professor Gilbert, and Professor Gilbert just invented a time travel helmet. So Mulligan, he jumps on the opportunity and uses the helmet to transport himself to 1960. And, well, once he gets to 1960, he's not so happy because the prices are higher and there's a lot more noise. So he meets, or I should say he runs into a man named Rollo. He's a scientist and an authority on the 1890s, and he regards...
And Lynn?
Yeah?
I can go ahead and help you out on that.
Can you?
That is the scene where they do a little info-dump on the whole situation.
Now, let me try to understand this, sir. You have this funny-looking hat in your hand, no pants, and you say you've got to get back to somewhere within 15 minutes, right?
Right. See, this is a time helmet. I'm from 1890, and that's where I got to get back to.
And your trousers?
I hung them up to dry in 1890.
Mm. You say you're from 1890, huh? What proof have you?
Proof?
Yes.
That watch.
Those clothes. Where did you get them?
They're mine.
Is it possible? Quickly, who is the president?
You mean Benjamin Harrison?
Benjamin Harrison. And before him?
Grover Cleveland. But what's that...
By George, I believe you, sir.
Just name the presidents, and I believe you.
There you go. So Rollo is thrilled. Rollo is thinking this is a great period, charming time period. But we unfortunately, the helmet got broken. So they take it to the repair shop to get it fixed. Isn't that wonderful? They had a repair shop right there.
Time travel repair shop.
The Maytag repairman was right there, Jesse White, and they want to get the helmet fixed, and he fixes it. After all this craziness, silliness, and carrying on, the repairman manages to fix the helmet. Mr. Rollo grabs the helmet, puts it on, and tries to go back all by himself. But Mulligan jumps on him, and they go back together. And guess what happens? The 1890s turn out to be not exactly what Rollo expected. Mulligan, he's thrilled to be back in his time and place. However, he has a newfound appreciation for it. But Rollo, he's complaining. He's not happy, you know. And in the little text there, Mulligan says, "Oh, well, this guy sounds worse than my mother-in-law." Well, that's a very lovely sentiment there and funny. But he has enough of Rollo and takes the helmet, puts it on his head, and he sends him back to his own time in the 1960s. So that's it for that episode. And this is one of Twilight Zone's comedy episodes.
Mulligan, that's me.
Thank you. The parts set in the 1890s, they have no sound. They're silent. It's those intertiles that are put in there, and the words are being spoken. The piano, little player piano, gets played in the background. But look, I have nothing against Buster Keaton. Or silent movies. Buster Keaton was a fine actor for his time. Silent movies were fine. But I don't bear a strong fondness for either Buster Keaton or silent movies. Neither of them belonged in a Twilight Zone episode. Now, I realized in the 1920s and 1930s, Buster Keaton was considered a premier actor, and silent movies were the form of screen entertainment. But in the 1960s and beyond, this was no longer the case. And I don't wish to read my movies. I don't want to watch foreign films. A lot of foreign films have subtitles. And for this reason, I don't watch them. Now, have I ever watched a foreign film in which I had to read most of the dialogue? Yes. Did I enjoy that? Very rarely. I think the only subtitle movie I ever truly enjoyed was Life is Beautiful with Roberto Benigni, but that was the exception. I don't know why this idea was ever thrown out to Rod Sterling for consideration.
Well, it was experiment, Lynn. You know, Doctor Who and other shows try experimenting. Unfortunately, this one just didn't work.
Yeah, it was one of the dumbest.
Well, hang on a minute. They just had The Artist win a load of Oscars. That's silent.
Which one?
The Artist.
Yeah, The Artist. But I'm talking about the time Twilight Zone did this. It just didn't really.
Yeah, but the fact that The Artist was a success shows that if done properly, it can have appeal.
It can work, yeah. And by the way, Dave, I do want to see that movie. That's on my list. But other than that, I mean, it was out of place. It was out of place as a Twilight Zone episode. Dialogue, of course, was to me, the dialogue was dumb. And many of the comedic moves were dumb. But they were, I guess they were in place for the time period that they should have been in, but not for 1960. And even for people who grew up in that era, or for people who like that sort of outdated primitive comedy, I still can't see how anybody could think it has a place in a series like this. But one thing, now I have to say, one thing that kept gnawing at me through this entire episode, Mulligan had 15 minutes to return to 1890. 15 minutes. And that was the longest 15 minutes I've ever seen. You're going to tell me, seriously, you're going to tell me that from the time he landed in 1960, chased the kid on the bicycle, ran from the cop, then went to the repair shop, then met Rollo, then went to the repair shop, and all the situation, that 15 minutes? Come on. He was way past his 15-minute mark, long past after he met Rollo. And, you know, I know.
Well, in
I
Twilight know. Zone time, it's like 5 minutes or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. They had to do it the way they did it. But, you know, you're going to tell me that you land in 1960, you're chasing a kid on a bicycle, you bang into another guy, you go to a repair shop, you're waiting for the guy, and 15 minutes has not passed. Got me a break. I mean, this is just, oh, well. Okay, they had to pretend that it didn't know because of the time period. But I'll give Buster Keaton credit. He agreed to appear on this horrible episode, and the story was terrible, jokes were worse, but I'm not a huge fan of Buster Keaton, but I do respect the work he did in the time period when his work was highly respected and admired.
Well, he was as popular as Charlie Chaplin and Harold Lloyd was during that
exactly.
time in the era.
Exactly. Yep. So that was then, and this is now. And come on, nobody can possibly believe that this episode belongs in the series, though. So I'm going to give it a 1 for poor, only because I wouldn't feel right giving Buster Keaton a 0. I really wouldn't. So I'll give it a 1. And I'm going to pass it over to you, Robert, and you tell me what you think.
Well, you know, I like the time travel element of the story more than anything. It's just jarring when they do the switches where they switch from the silent to the sound and then back again. Because then you have, you know, the music, and then, like the first switch, you have the music and the sound like this. And there he is standing in the middle of the street with no pants, a chicken in his hand, and people tell him, get out of the street.
Well, I think that was the point, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it adds to his confusion.
And then we get the second switch where we switch back from the sound portion to the silent again. And that's what I feel threw me out of the story is just those two where they switch back and forth like that. I mean, you know, either make it all silent or all sound is the way I looked at this story. I don't know if people would like a totally silent Twilight Zone with the cue cards. I don't know if that would work. Maybe the representation of the episode was to extinguish between the silent 1800s that Buster Keaton Mulligan's character was in, and then into the 1960s where we enter a hustle and bustle life. I mean, I can understand that, but man, it just, I don't know. And as I say, and as Davis said, here again, it seems very much like a bite of the two cherries again, because we've had this back in Execution, where the device in Execution was the time booth, and bringing the killer that was
being
hung,
yeah,
back to our century, and then he goes back again. So it just seems like it's the same thing again. And I mean, man, that helmet is so bad looking. I mean, it looked like, you know, a 5-year-old with a Rector set put that hat together.
There you go. That's the way. Yeah, and the Rector set. that we had when we were kids, right? Exactly.
Like 4th of July sparklers and a little almost barbershop pole thing onto the side. And even if we look back at the past time travel stories like Back There and other ones where, you know, we faint and then we're back, we didn't have no device at all where we used our mind to travel back. But, I mean, we could have at least come up with a better device. I understand during that time and, you know, going into, you know, the 1900s, 10s, 20s, and so on, how we had vacuum tubes and all that stuff, and things were just big. I mean, computers even back in the 50s and 60s could take up a whole room. But just the idea of the scientist back in the 1800s refer pretty much back to that Star Trek episode where Spock is trying to put together the one with Joan Collins in that episode.
Oh, yeah.
With the Guardian. Yeah, with the Guardian. And then Spock's trying to put together like a tricorder so he could review the history or whatever, you know, provided some power to get it working. I don't have nothing against silent movies. I mean, one that I mentioned in my review was Metropolis. Very much. I think it was 1929 when Metropolis came out. It was like right on the cusp of getting over into the talkies. But I do like the soundtrack that they did. They did a revision of it in the 1980s, I think it was, with some modern-day music with Pat Benatar, Bonnie Tyler, Freddie Mercury. I do like the new soundtrack that they did to Metropolis. But I did see both versions of it. I did watch the original with the original soundtrack. And, you know, that basically story is about the working class and the ones that work below and the ones that live atop, evil scientists building a robot to create havoc on that town. So another one I also brought up, and I brought up on a couple of shows, was the Buffy season 4 episode Hush. Where
I mentioned that.
There wasn't that much. I mean, they do the same thing too, where they go from sound to silent. But there, with that, you have a reason for that. I got a little clip of Whedon talking about filming that episode at the Paisleys when they had the whole cast there talking about Buffy, and Hush was mentioned.
For me, was the hardest.
Yeah.
I think it was one of those moments where I thought, oh, this is great. You know, a whole episode with no lines. Like, this is a breeze. And boy, was I wrong.
The writing it, first of all, I was like, I was terrified. Just totally more terrified than with the musical. I just couldn't pull it off. But then when we were shooting it, because everybody knew their action, but there were no lines, there was no rhythm, there was no cue. So I would call action, and everybody would do everything all at once.
But yeah, that's a pretty good episode about the evil monsters called the Gentlemen and how they couldn't stand sound of any kind, so they had to take the sound away. And so for a majority of that episode, it was very much silent until they go back. But at least with that episode, it wasn't as jarring as this one was. I ended up giving it a 1.5 out of 5, and the 1 being for the time travel element, which I did like, and the 0.5
for Buster Keaton, right?
Yeah, pretty much about it. The rest of the story sucked, unfortunately.
I know. You just like it's a low, like a respect thing. It's like I hated this episode, but I had, out of respect, I had to give it a 1. Rating because you can't give Buster Keaton a 0. I mean, I'm not a big fan of his, but I understand that, you know, the man's a legend. I understand he's a legend, an icon, and so to give him a 0 would be a disgrace. However, we do have Rick here. Rick showed up.
Hey.
Rick. And Ed is coming in shortly. Ed said he's having a problem with his login, but he's going to be here soon. And so I'm going to we're turning this over to Bobby.
Bobby,
right now.
Go ahead, Bobby.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Well, normally I would be rather down about having to discuss such a horrible episode as this. But in fact, there is reason to celebrate. And that is because by the time this show is over, we will have survived this absolutely dreadful three-episode story arc from The Twilight Zone that practically sank the series in the middle of its five-year run. 4 weeks ago, we started this, and mercifully, we ended today and move on to some real classic episodes coming up soon. Once again, we have The Twilight Zone trying to be amusing and failing miserably. I'll never understand why a man like Rod Serling, who had found magic in a bottle like some of the fictional characters in some of his stories, never got over this need to prove he could be amusing. It never, ever, ever works. This one, though, is even worse. Now, I have to admit that I brought a lot of bias to this episode. I have no interest in silent films and no interest in Buster Keaton. Even if it was great, I would have disliked it. Silent films were, thankfully, long before my time, and I've always felt that dialogue between characters is the best part of any story. I could never review it solely on the basis of its worth. I would need a real silent film and Buster Keaton fan, and to my amazement, I found one. I always visit IMDb to see what others think about various episodes. Once Upon a Time amazingly gets a 7.1 rating out of 10 from the nearly 300 people who bothered to vote. Only 8 of them posted reviews on the board there. Virtually all of them love it except for one. And that's no big deal. There's one in every crowd, and usually it's me. But this time I found one in agreement. I want to read his review because it's about as unbiased as you can be, something I can't be, something you will never get from me. His review is from 2007 and pretty short. And here it is. The following is from that person, that poster, not from me. He puts at the top of his post in the headline there, "Buster, how could you?" And he writes, "I am one of the biggest fans of silent comedians and have probably reviewed more Buster Keaton films for IMDb than any other person. Every film he made from the beginning of his career to the early 30s, with only two exceptions, have I reviewed. So you can tell I'm a major fan. It's because of this that I found this episode so painful and hard to watch. I loved this man's films and kept thinking, Buster, how could you? Well, now that I think about it, I guess I can see why Buster Keaton starred in this god-awful episode of The Twilight Zone. He lost much of his fortune after a messy divorce in the early 30s, and his film career as a leading man was long past as well. Now, in the 1960s, Keaton needed the money and loved his resurgence in popularity, so he whored himself out to anyone willing to pay, appearing in beach films and this mess of an episode of a great series. The biggest problem with the episode is that it is just terribly written, and Buster deserves much better. The show is supposed to be funny, but isn't. Instead of a tribute to silent films, it's just painful to watch. Particularly with Keaton putting that stupid time travel helmet on, as well as all the poorly executed slapstick. Do yourself a favor, skip this one. It's a pale imitation of the greatness that once was Keaton's career." That's the end of his post. And all I can say is, if a man who is that much of a silent film fan can't tolerate this, then obviously there's nothing worthwhile about it. And I certainly agree with his comments. As that poster mentioned, Keaton did appear in two talking classics, Beach Black and Bingo and How to Stuff a Wild Bikini, 4 years after appearing in this Twilight Zone episode. And that's, frankly, about the only place I've ever really watched him. But I don't remember anything about what he did because I was too busy watching Annette walk around half naked and hoping that her top would fall off.
I've seen both of those, too. Yeah.
Keaton died about a year after those beach movies, most likely of embarrassment. As for my rating, a 0, obviously, although on our group message board in my review, I felt inspired to create a new rating and gave it that, and that is E, for excruciating, for obvious reasons. It's just, as the man said, god-awful. And I just, You know, I cannot understand this desire. I mean, I understand that people who are good at something try to extend what they do. If you write great mysteries, you might think, I'm going to write a comedy one day and really fool everybody. And that's what he did. But look at somebody like Alfred Hitchcock. Other than the fact that a couple of his movies, like The Trouble with Harry and one or two other ones, have a few amusing moments in them, he wrote mysteries and wrote, you know, horror movies like Psycho. He didn't try to write a comedy. It would have looked ridiculous, and nobody would have liked it. Serling needed to keep that in mind and stop this nonsense about trying this. We've been through a lot of them before. We've got more coming up yet. I mean, it's frightening to think that we're not even through with this. And it's just every time it comes up, I just sit here and hold my head and just moan. I'll tell you what, it would be fine with me if it was actually funny. Do something funny, and I'll say, well, you know, it surprised me. But it's just not funny at all. And this is just, you know, I mean, I've never really sat. I've seen some silent movies, parts of them, usually in documentaries about silent films, about Buster Keaton. But I get nothing out of it because I think that it's so far past that era, you really can't get into it. Back then, it was funny to people because that's all they had. That's what movies were. They were silent. And so you deal with what you've got. Today, we've got all these great things in front of us, all these great advancements. But 100 years from now, when none of us are here, people are going to look at movies or whatever it is back at that time and say, did people actually watch movies that way back in 2012? That's incredible. But you can only deal with what's in front of you. And I just never really got anything out of silent movies because, like I said before, I like dialogue. I like really snappy dialogue, people confronting each other. Those are the things that you really remember. And plus, my attention isn't that great when I'm watching a movie. And if you've only got what's happening on the screen, you got to watch every second of it or you're missing something. So it's just terrible. It's a terrible episode. It's embarrassing for everybody. And it's just a shame. I give Keaton credit for what he was. Obviously, he was a genius at what he did when he did it. But he should have passed on this one. He should have taken one look at this script and told Rod Serling, you know, I mean, I don't think I really want to trash my career this way. Of course, he appeared in beach movies, and if you're going to do that, do just about anything.
Didn't he appear on It's a Mad, 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 Mad World as an Indian?
Yeah, he was in that too. Very briefly.
Yeah,
everybody in comedy was in that movie for two seconds.
And Felix, remember, Felix said that Buster Keaton was better used in those cheesy beach blanket movies.
Yeah, that really, you really got to trash your career when you're in that. And but all I can do is give it a zero. I can't really give Buster Keaton any points for being who he is because there's nothing to do with this. As a comedian, yeah, I guess he deserves a lot of credit, but he should not have done this. It was simply a very, very bad idea. So now we're through with this, and I just dread thinking about the comedy episodes that are coming up yet, but thankfully we had three episodes, the Passersby and the Jungle and this, at least to me, were just horrible. I can't imagine what I was thinking when I originally saw this when I was a kid. I must have thought, what is happening to my series? I don't even understand any of this. So it's just horrible to sit through, and I'm just thank God it's over, and let's move on. Okay, Lynn, that's
Robbie,
it for me. Yeah.
Before we switched on, I wanted to ask you a question. What did you think about the situation? Okay, he's time traveling. He has no money, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he ends up running the streets with the other guy. What was the other guy's name again?
Rollo.
The scientist? Rollo, okay.
Rollo.
Yeah.
And then he grabs the pair of pants off the rack. He conveniently finds money in the pair of pants to pay for the pair of pants he stole, plus to pay for the helmet to be fixed. What did you think about that convenience?
Well, I mean, it's absurd, but you get that in a lot of stories. Many times, characters in stories do things, and you turn around 5 seconds later and go, how the hell did he do that? And so that doesn't surprise me. That's not only true here. I can point out other episodes of this series, other series that are really good, where you go, wait a minute, this isn't something missing here. Continuity is always a problem. They never explain how you come up with money all of a sudden or anything like that.
I don't have money. I don't know how
you come up with money. You're not paying close enough attention. You'll never notice it.
At least Doc Brown had a suitcase of different denominations from different years.
Yeah, yeah. It makes not a bit of sense. But then the whole thing doesn't make any sense, so it doesn't matter. All righty.
All righty, Dave.
Well, here comes the yin to that yang, I suppose. Although I didn't, like I had to say last week, I didn't get to rewatch this episode just recently, but I have watched it in the past, and I do remember being confused quite greatly, as people have said, about why it was included as a Twilight Zone. But often, of course, this is what happens with series, that the oddball one sometimes actually does get an affectionate rating by people, and that might explain to Bobby a bit why this, for him, bewilderingly got a reasonable score. I mean, take like the reference to Star Trek, and one of the actors that's in this was also in the Trouble with Tribbles episode. The chap who played, come on, this is where Robert will have to help me.
Had to describe it.
Yeah, the Rolo.
The guy who played
Stanley Abbins. Yeah, the guy who played Stanley Abbins.
Oh, okay, Rolo. Yeah, he played the guy, the heavy set guy that always drank and tried
to get free drinks. The trader who brought the Tribbles on.
With the Romulans, Klingons.
When Star Trek did that comedy episode, Trouble with Tribbles, I don't think initially I actually got a good rating. People were thinking, what's this in Star Trek for? You know what I mean? I do, bearing in mind that this is sort of a run to the litter in that sense, and doesn't really fit into the content, I think it should get a little bit of kudos for as an experiment. It wasn't repeated, so fair enough. It was, and for Robert, I will also say this, it's a little bit like when we had in Doctor Who the Doctor Light episode, and we had
Fear Her,
but I'm thinking about the one before that, Love and Monsters, where the main thing was that a lot of people didn't like it, but they admired the fact that they took the risk and did it. So that's it. And I also am like Robert, I do like time travel. Secondly, I think that jarring that Robert said about the sound, I think that was done on purpose so that you got this, the sheer jarring and clash of, to us, I mean, don't forget when we're watching it now, even the 1960s seems slow and laid back. We've had episodes where, and I can't remember if it was the one that Robert mentioned, but one where somebody goes out into the noisy street and he can't believe how noisy everywhere is, because of, he's just not used to that amount of noise.
The execution one, yeah, where he goes and runs out
the
street.
It was the execution, yeah. That's the right one. Yeah, the one. So, quite right, thank you, Robert, for that, and picking up on my sort of two bites at the cherry that he does. I mean, this has been successfully done. The Buffy episode you referred to, The Wish, all right, that was done with a far higher budget and a lot, 25 years later. The artist has just been, everybody before
you mean
the
Hush.
Artist came.
Yeah.
Hush, what did I say?
You said The Gift with Anna back.
Hush. With the artist, nobody thought that was going to get the critical acclaim that it did. But, people said, how can you hold a silent movie for the whole length?
It was an incredibly beautiful romantic time.
It's simple. Great filmmaking.
It's movie magic. That's where it all happens.
The Artist. It's a love story not only for a man and a woman, it's also a love story about motion pictures.
George is the star, came up through vaudeville, a dancer, got a dog act, and he settled into a groove with one character that he plays, some guy with a mask and a top hat who solves crimes and runs around with dames. He is the linchpin star of the studio. His projects brought a lot of money in. He's a really good looking guy. He's got a ton of personality.
Debbie Miller is an actress who happens to bump into George Valentine at an opening and get her photograph in the trades. Just a little bit of recognition, which gives her the courage to come on and begin to work her way up through the ranks. She has an incredible personality, and she sings, and she's uninhibited.
This girl, Peppy Miller, has got what Eleanor Glenn in the 20s called it.
She has something very spontaneous, a lot of energy. She's always smiling, and she's always moving. Her body is always full of life, and she's a good person all the way. And I think that's why she's beautiful.
This is right at the advent of sound, and George thinks talking pictures are a joke. He doesn't seem to have any self-doubt, but you can tell the world around him is changing.
George rejects the new technology. He cannot even conceive of it as a way to express himself.
The story is about their two destinies. He's going to fall, and she becomes a huge star.
George Valentin is representative of a lot of actors who found themselves at the pinnacle of their careers in the late 1920s, only to suddenly be faced with obsolescence by the early 1930s.
He's very proud. He's like, no, I don't want to go there. And Pepe falls in love with him and believes in him, and it's a beautiful love story.
Towards the end of the movie, there's this incredible tap number between the two French leads, and it's so beautiful.
It's so hopeful. And they dance the exuberance of the possibility that their lives are going to work out.
I love those films. Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, Gene Kelly. I mean, this was one of the reasons I wanted to be an actress. I wanted to be part of that experience and be those people. I mean, I can't dance like that, but the beauty of them is they're not even trained professional dancers, and they're incredible.
We studied for 5 months, and the first week it's fun. Shuffle a step, shuffle a step, shuffle a step. Okay. The fifth week it's a little boring, and at the end it's thrilling.
And we knew it was going to be one shot. We didn't want to be cut or, you know, and Michelle always said, just smile all the way. Look at each
energy,
other.
Energy, smile.
Play together. And so people are not going to look at your feet. We were like, okay. It was such a pleasure. I think for the audience to see an actor doing something he's not supposed to know, dance, sing, I don't know, whatever, it's always a pleasure because you can really see the work. That, you know, you don't see the work of an actor, really. But the tap dancing, it's like, oh my God, they did that for 5 months just for us, just for 2 minutes. And yeah.
17 takes.
Yeah, 17 takes.
In your legs.
Movie making can be, and I say can be, an art form and a beautiful one. And I think this movie captures all of that on so many levels, visually, emotionally. I think audiences are in for such an incredible treat.
What's exciting about it is you have a movie using the techniques that were in use in the 20s and 30s to tell a contemporary story to a modern audience, and that's why the picture is as great as it is.
This truly is a great film, whatever era. People will be talking about this film and referencing it in many years to come.
Now, and also to address what Lynn said, yes, I think they were taking liberties with, you know, this 15-minute mark. But again, quite often in science fiction films, it will be 40 minutes before the end of the episode. And therefore, in the narration, somebody will say, you know, the ship's about to explode. It's counting down. We've got 40 minutes to stop the thing. As they did in a Doctor Who episode called 42. So sometimes that real-life time is used as a plot device, admittedly not very successfully in this one. As to Buster Keaton, I've got mixed feelings about him. Obviously, sometimes it's strange to see an actor that you see with a young face and then suddenly you're seeing them, you know, 20, 30 years later performing and you think, why haven't they given up already? I remember famously before they started doing, plastic surgery on actors and actresses, are them choosing to have it, should I say. Basically, they would always say that artists turn into a caricature of themselves because they sort of, they try and put wigs on and plaster the makeup on and have it very heavy. And when they're in the 50s, they can look a caricature of what they were in the 20s because they're still wearing the same sort of clothes.
I agree
still
with
trying
you
to pull
on that.
Off. Yeah. I mean, this is not to say that this woman isn't still very, very beautiful, but I was watching a programme on BBC last night, Graham Norton interview, and it was Cameron Diaz on. And she's got a new film out, which I can't remember the name of it, but she's playing, you know, a woman who's pregnant. Now, I don't know how old Cameron Diaz is, but she must be in her mid-40s, and, you know, 30. She should have been playing that.
She's in her 30s.
Is she?
Late 30s.
I thought she was in her 40s now. Anyway,
late 30s.
It seemed to be, it's the same with Jennifer Aniston, who I love Jennifer Aniston, but, it's beginning to be that, you know, she's still playing rom-coms, you know, first boyfriend crushes, and she's in her early 40s, you know what I mean? So, anyway, so I think with that, when you see somebody like Buster Keaton, obviously he's, I think he was nearly 70 when he did this part, that slightly looks strange to you. The other thing is, and I would say in his defence, that all his good work is where he directed himself. And of course, in The Twilight Zone, we've already said the budget has been cut, hence the poor effects with the time helmet and so on. And also, of course, he didn't have much chance to direct himself. But one of the things I did manage to catch before tonight's show was just the first sort of 5 minute scene where he's walking down the street, you know, with the animals and the penny farthing and that.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he's still got it there to my mind. He carries off the expressions and the bewilderment and the look and, the little thing with the policeman and so on and the falling into the water tank and the pratfall, as you'd call it. I thought it was all right. So I'm going to say, it's probably only a 2 out of 5, but probably because for the fact that they tried something different and, it's a little bit of younger people, even in the 60s, probably seeing Buster Keaton for the first time, it was worth it for that. So
you give it a 2? A 2 out of 5?
No, I'm going to give it a 3. No, I'm going to give it a 3. I'm going to double what Robert says. Where I'm giving it... Instead of one for the episode, give 2.
You're going to do
instead
a double shot on me, aren't you?
Okay. Instead of half a Buster Keaton, one for him.
Oh, Dave, did you notice, too, that during the silent and then going to, modern day, then back to silent again, during the silent areas, remember, Dave, that they used to use white powder on their faces to, makeup to make it stand up?
Yeah.
And you notice Rollo has that white powder stuff when he goes back. So, I don't know if you noticed that or not.
Yeah, cool. Okay, well, I'm going to turn it over to Rick, and then after Rick, I want to hear from Ed. So, okay, Rick, what do you have to say?
As Bob said, there's always one in the crowd. Well, actually, I think I'm not alone because Dave gave about the same I'm going to give. However, I love silent movies. Okay? Movies are moving pictures, not moving radio.
Okay.
You do not really need dialogue. If you have a well-photographed or cinematographed movie. Having said that, I'm going to say something I've said before. Serling is not a comedy writer, however, in this show. But I enjoyed it. I think the Yeah, all right, maybe the budget was cut, but I think the helmet looked stupid because it was supposed to be from the 1860s.
Well, now, Rick, you're a movie producer.
Yeah.
You produce the movies, right? Okay.
Yes.
In this day and age, would you even consider a silent movie?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
The Artist?
The Artist. I completely forgot. You're right, Dave. The Artist. Okay. And that got quite a high rating from the critics.
Yeah, got a lot of Oscars, too. I think wasn't Best Actor,
exactly,
Best Picture.
Exactly. Yeah. First one, though. First one in many, many, many years. Many years.
True.
So other than that, Rick, would you consider doing a silent film?
Yes.
Okay.
Rick, you could do Cabin in the Woods silent. I think that would be
well, I have heard that some horror people still want to do a remake of Nosferatu. Is it Nosferatu? The early vampire.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Now, whether they're going to do it as a silent one again or not, I don't know. But
so I'd give it a 2.5.
2.5? Okay.
Was it anything I've seen before? Yeah. Did it break any new ground? No. But unlike a lot of people, especially my co-writer of Harrow House, or actually the writer of Harrow House, I don't think you have to break ground on everything you make. And like I said, I enjoyed it.
But Rick, let me ask you, should it have gone one way or the other, or was it proper to be mixed like that? Shouldn't have been like an old. Why couldn't they do this all silent from beginning to end?
No.
Maybe, but I don't think Serling's that strong a writer to
I
do
don't
something
think it
like
worked.
That.
I don't if think it would have worked.
If that was the script, no, it wouldn't have worked if it was all silent. No.
Yeah. No, it wouldn't have worked. Not from beginning to end. I think people have tuned out at that point. Yeah. Even though it was the 1960s, I think people would have tuned out if it was all silent. People would say, what the hell is this? You know,
ones that would have got it during that time would have been in their 50s or 60s anyway, because they were teens in the 30s.
And it wasn't
a silent movie, remember, because there's a soundtrack as well.
Right.
Bobby, I think you mentioned about the silent Buffy episode, yes?
Me, that didn't come from me.
Yeah, it came from me, Rick.
Robert.
Oh. That was one of the highest rated shows in all of Buffy.
Well, he did that Once More with Feeling was two experiments that he did that worked well. But it fitted in that series, I felt, more than this one did in Twilight Zone.
True.
So Rick, what is your rating on this one?
2.5.
All right, 2.5. All right. And Ed. Hello, Ed. I hope you're here.
Hello. Can you guys hear me okay?
Oh, Ed's here. All right. Okay.
All right. My usual microphone is completely messed up. I don't know what's going on, but here I am anyway. Either way, calling
it
in.
You sound great. You sound great.
Oh, good. All right. I'm glad I sound okay. All right. Well, wow. You guys are harsh. I can understand your, you know, the irritation with the show, but I got to say, don't let it get into your skin so much. It's just a show. But either way.
Well, Ed, let me welcome you in.
Hi. How you doing?
There you go. Let me buy you a drink. Let's talk this out. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
But I'm not silent anymore. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, first of all, I have to say I am also a bit biased. I love... And seriously, you can ask my wife this one. I love bad time travel movies. I love them. It is my favorite genre. I will surf around looking for them on TV. I will set my TiVo to get bad movies. And time travel is my favorite. If I have a night free,
oh, like Jeff,
I've got nothing to
Jeff. Yeah, remember him in the Trancer movies?
You know, it's funny because if I have nothing to do one night, I'll go to the other side of the house and I'll tell my wife I'm going to go watch some old crap, and she knows what that means. It means I'm going to watch an old bad sci-fi.
Oh, wait a minute. How about Somewhere in Time, Christopher Reeve?
Oh, I've seen it. Yes, where he falls asleep in a room, and then because he can't see anything modern.
Jane Seymour.
Tell me you love that movie. Yeah, I love that movie, and I love it because it's bad. But it's not bad in that it's badly produced. It's just the acting is so – not Jane Seymour. Christopher Reeve, I found him to be so stiff in that movie. But anyway, but he is Superman after all.
No, that was fabulous. Oh, my God, I cried.
But you got to understand now. Wait a minute. You got to follow me now. Follow me through here. It was bad, but that means I loved it. I loved the movie.
I loved it. I mean, oh my God, I cried like four times during the movie. Every time I see it, I cry. And I know.
You got to remember, Somewhere in Time was basically back then only longer, and instead of Russell Johnson, you have Christopher Reeve.
And it's two people are falling in love with each other because they're good looking.
A remake of a French movie called La Jete.
There you go. All right. Okay. And they're falling in love with each other because they're both good looking. So there's no real substance there. But it's still, I love the movie. It makes me cry. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. No. Don't be sorry. I actually do like that movie, but I like it for completely different reasons, obviously. Anyway, it's a good story, too, by the way. But getting back to the episode here, I actually liked it a lot. I've seen it probably 15 times in my life, so I've seen it a lot. In fact, I've seen it so often that I spotted something in this episode that I noticed a long time ago. There's actually a scene in this movie that is filmed in the exact same spot as another scene in the jungle. And it's the scene where they're in the alley. That alley is the exact same alley that our main character in the jungle goes into after he's approached by the vagrant and goes looking for him. He goes running into an alley. It's the exact same alley. If you want to see something, how's this for spending time on useless things? If you want to see this, you can go to, I put a little temporary link with two screenshots up on the internet. It's on, if you want to write this down or type it up, tinyurl, so tinyurl.com/ Talking Twilight Zone. Hit enter. You'll see the two screenshots from the two shows, and you'll see they're the exact same place, just dressed up a little bit different. The same.
Yeah, Lynn brought that up, too, about the reuse of sets, and especially the one we just reviewed this week on Jet Myrtlebank. Remember, you brought up about the fence being reused and the house being reused from the hunt.
Well,
yeah.
The low budget that they had, very, very low budget. And because of that low budget, they had to use sets over and over and over again.
What was the end of the URL?
Tiny.com.
Yeah, I'll spell it out for you. It's T as in Thomas, I as in, well.
I've got tiny.com. Talking Twilight Zone.
Yep, tinyurl.com/ Talking Twilight Zone, all one word. Hit enter. You'll see two screenshots. You can compare them. Now, the episode itself, understanding that, Buster Keaton was, I think somebody mentioned, he was almost 70. I think he was late 60s anyway. The fact that he was 67 years old, and he really hadn't been in his prime for a very long time, where in the 1920s he did all those really big stunts. If you want to see some of his work on YouTube, it's really amazing what the guy did. He put his life in jeopardy to get some of the stunts that he got done. He used to jump from third stories onto a plank. You know, he'd fall from, you know, high trees and do a pratfall onto the ground. You know, he just did some amazing things.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, he was quite the stuntman just to get a physical gag on film.
Wow.
And you know, the fact that at 60-something years old he could still do. I mean, I loved the scene where he's going into the basement hatch. He just turns around for a second. He falls straight out of his face, bounces back up. You know, it's just fun. The episode was meant to be goofy. Did it fit the canon of the Twilight Zone? Not really. I mean, it was done just to be something different and goofy. I know. If you take it too seriously, yeah, you could hate it. But I liked it. I just liked it. I liked the goofy things like where he's wandering around in the repair shop while, you know, our repairman is, you know, tinkering around with the creation. Jesse
Maytag,
White.
This guy
Maytag.
Has no buttons.
Exactly. Yeah, Jesse White, who was the Maytag man
Maytag
a few years later.
Maytag repairman.
That's right.
This guy's got no buttons.
Yeah.
Kind of prophetic, actually.
Seriously, isn't that prophetic? Because he played a repairman, and then
yeah.
Later on, he was the Maytag repairman. So I think that's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome.
Hey, Ed.
I thought, yeah.
I go ahead and got that clip if you want me to play it. I'll go ahead and play it
sure.
For you here.
There you are, gentlemen. All fixed.
Good. Well, what do we do now?
Pay me.
Mm-hmm. Pay the man. Pay the man.
Just the right amount. Thank you.
How does it work?
Oh, you just set this dial.
Good.
Hey, what are you doing?
I intend to use it myself in exactly 3 minutes.
Well, you can't do that.
Well, I am doing it, sir. I'm returning to that time of bliss and simple pleasures.
And leaving me here?
Your fate is not important, sir. You are a janitor.
And go back to the Tribbles. Or forward to the Tribbles. Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. I liked it. I mean, it had a lot of fun moments, and the dialogue was, some of it was pretty bad, but, you know, like I said, if it was just meant to be something different, I wasn't going to...
But now, Ed, do you really
yeah.
believe it should be a Twilight Zone episode?
No, absolutely not, but
all
I loved
right.
it anyway.
That's what I wanted to know. Okay.
Yeah,
all
no,
right.
it did not fit as a Twilight Zone episode, but I liked it. If it was a standalone production, it was in some other series that had a, you
right.
know...
Yeah.
A completely different format.
It was cued for something else.
Yes, it was. It definitely
yeah.
is. It definitely is.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, great. Well, so what is your rating?
One through five. I give it four. I give it four. I just because
really?
I happen
okay,
to
cool.
I happen to find it very amusing. Even if it's not a Twilight Zone, you know, deep thinking episode, it's fun. Although it's got a you know, little bit of a lesson to it. You know, the grass is always greener on the other side of time, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was basically, to me, that was basically the message, was
yeah, yeah.
the grass is always greener on the other side, and I think that was the message of this. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So you give it a four. So anybody else have anything left to say?
Yes.
And
well,
let me see.
You need to read what Felix put in text.
Yep.
Text.
He put
that's
a rating.
What I'm looking at. Text. Okay. Let me see.
Sorry, I'm on another page here. He
yeah,
had a
well,
two for
said,
trying.
Oh, yeah, two for trying the idea
yeah.
of time travel, yeah. And he also mentions the Invaders, and that was like a solid movie because there was hardly any dialogue, but he enjoyed that. And Groucho Marx, okay. He mentions that in his old age, it was a so-called comedy called, what is it? Robert, can you see that?
Yeah, I got to get back to it here.
Skidoo. He said the movie was more like, okay.
And
all
particularly
right.
the duck did fall on that movie for me. It was terrible. It was doo-doo.
Yeah.
It was missing Mr. Feldman. Mr. Feldman, where are you?
That's great. That was really good. So now, okay, where are we here?
Well, before we take off here, I just want to bring up we're at the site here, where I am. And ratings-wise, looks like the most was zero. We had four people pick zero. We had two pick people picked 4-1. Me and somebody else picked 1.5. We got two that picked 3 for good and then 1 for average. Nobody picked 4 through 5 on any
So basically we're at an average of 3, I think, right? Would you think?
Zero. Zero, 3.
Oh, my goodness.
Whichever one you want to go.
Oh, my God. An average of 0. Well,
see, Bobby, you have people supporting you on that one.
Of course. I'm a genius. It's obvious.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my.
Well, let me see something here. Now, we're, I'm just checking things out. Once upon a okay, Oh, 2 weeks from now. Ooh.
Excitement, isn't it?
Ooh. 2 weeks from now. Okay,
Miss Takata.
Miss Takata. Mr. Cotter. 2 weeks from now. June 9th. That is 6/9 for those who have a problem with the spoken word
numbering system. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and we are looking at Saturday, June 9th. We are looking at 5 characters in search of an ex.
5 characters. Anybody remember the count from Sesame Street? 5.
Five.
Okay, we'll start with the letter A today.
They're going 5 characters in search of an E exit. All right. And this is like I can't even talk anymore. I'm so excited. I'm excited about the week now. Am I the only one excited about 2 weeks from now, or what?
Yeah. Hey, it was better than today. So, not quite that bad, but.
Now, I need to know. I want to know right now. Okay, Ed, I'm sure you'll be here 2 weeks from now, right?
Well, I would like to. It's actually my anniversary weekend, so we will be gone that weekend. But if I can possibly.
You mean you're putting your anniversary above this?
I know, really, right? What were my priorities?
I have no. Honestly, these people just can't get their priorities in order. Happy anniversary.
Yeah,
thank
happy
you.
Anniversary there, Ed.
Thank you.
Pretty early.
Is it a big one?
No, number 12. Not major.
Oh, well,
but,
that's not the one. God, 12? That's
yeah,
not 12. Celebrate the 12th anniversary. Come on, just show up here. 12. If you were to say 10 or 15 or 20, but 12? And you're blowing us up for 12?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Throw some chicken McNuggets at her and just, you know.
I'll listen in the podcast, I promise.
Jeez, you know, that you throw a couple of McNuggets, give her a...
It's got to be silk.
How about a bucket of chicken?
12th anniversary, you give silk.
At least it's not wood. Or paper.
Here's a log for you. I'm going to go on a talk show now. Go away.
A bucket of chicken, give her a glass of champagne, and get the hell over here.
And give her a chicken in a pot. 2 chickens in a pot.
There you go. There you
and
go.
Another Wyduck. Duck.
All
2 chickens
right.
And a Wyduck.
Oh, well.
You could give her a tin of jellied drumsticks
out of a can.
Out of a can.
Well, hey, how about if you and your wife show up here and we could spend your anniversary together here?
Yeah, I doubt she'd do that. I tried to get her on these things. She won't come on.
Well, just make sure you have the couch handy there, Ed, in case, you know, you decide something like that.
The what?
All right, well, that's not going to work. All right, Rick, you're going to be here, aren't you?
Oh.
There somewhere.
His spider sense are tingling there. What is it, Rick?
I'll try. My brother might have a cookout.
All right, you know what? You know what? I'm gonna cry. I'm gonna cry. Do you care? People care if I even cry? I'm gonna cry.
You're crying in silence.
Sit here, and I am going to stop. And I'm gonna stop right here, so everyone can hear me. And I'm gonna let them know who I'm stopping for: Ed, Rick, and anybody who's not here. And I'm gonna cry, and that. So you guys just better be ready for that.
I'm going to try, unless my brother has a cookout or something. I'll be here.
Okay, guys. Here is my address. So send an MP3 if you want to do that.
What, to hear Lynn cry?
Yeah.
I'm going to cry, literally cry over here. And then when the next time you come in and listen to it, you will hear what you've done to me. You will hear how you have literally, like, taken over my entire being and made me cry. Okay. That's okay. All right. Cool. And you guys really don't give a shit, do you? All right. So, Ed and Rick and Dave and Robert and everybody who is here, including my darling Bobby, who is still here. I hope, Bobby, you have not fallen asleep yet, have you?
I'm trying to.
All right.
Just hanging.
I've taken a vow of silence.
And I love you all very much. And so I will be here in 2 weeks, and whoever can be here, I hope you will be here on June 9th for 5 characters in search of an exit. And I'm going to exit right now by saying have a wonderful weekend, folks.
Isn't that what we are right now, 5 characters in search of an exit?
5 characters in search. And
exit,
there are
stage
5
left.
Of us here. Mm. Yeah, there are actually 5 of us here right now. So have a wonderful weekend, folks. I love you all. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye, all.
Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, Sue Clarkey with you for Perspective. Quick pop quiz for you. What American television series ran from 1959 to 1964 with a total of 156 episodes? More clues? Its creator, narrator, and more often than not, writer, was born in 1925 and died in 1975. Even more, it's considered to be the first real adult science fantasy anthology series to appear on television. Got it? Okay, with the answer, Canberra-based historian Barry York.
Consider, if you will, a 10-year-old boy bathed in the blue-grey hue of a television cathode ray, clinging to every word of dialogue, every scene, every change in pace and mood of a weekly half-hour series, palms sweating in anticipation of the inevitable twist and message in the tale. The place is Brunswick, Melbourne. The year, 1961. The boy is me. And the series is The Twilight Zone. Now fast forward to 2008, and that boy, now 57, stands in the middle of leafy Bennett Avenue, Binghamton, upstate New York, outside the house in which The Twilight Zone's creator, Rod Serling, was raised. Have I wandered into a Twilight Zone episode? No. This is part of a family holiday, and it was inconceivable to me that we could visit New York and not make the 3-hour trip upstate, way off the tourist trail, to Rod Serling's hometown. We're greeted at Binghamton by Larry Casson, founder and director of the annual Rod Serling Video Festival. Larry is as generous as he is fast-talking. He also has the most infectious laugh you'll find anywhere on the planet. He shows us the main Serling sites, the high school Serling attended, the permanent exhibition at the Forum Theatre, the star engraved into Binghamton's Walk of Fame, and the carousel at Recreation Park that inspired one of the best episodes. In that episode, called Walking Distance, an overworked executive is so desperate to return to his childhood home that he actually does so, only to learn that he belongs in the present, not the past, and that life is best lived by looking ahead with confidence. His career as a successful teleplay writer predated The Twilight Zone by several years, and the first of his six Emmy Awards was won in 1956. He devised The Twilight Zone because he was frustrated by the interference of television sponsors in his earlier dramatic scripts. A case in point was his teleplay, A Town Has Turned to Dust, which he based on the 1955 murder in Mississippi of 14-year-old black American Emmett Till. The television network and sponsors emasculated Serling's strong anti-racism message. As Rod Serling later put it, by the time A Town Has Turned to Dust went before the cameras, my script had turned to dust. Emmett Till became a romantic Mexican. The setting was moved to the southwest of the 1870s. The phrase 20 men in hoods became 20 men in homemade masks. Serling decided to evade future censorship by making his social criticisms through allegories of science fiction and fantasy. The Twilight Zone was an important prelude to the rebellious spirit of the second half of the 1960s. In The Twilight Zone, stories were not always neatly resolved, but often left the viewer wondering, thinking for ourselves. In the zone, perspective is played with and undermined. The values and principles holding the series together were clear. Prejudice and tyranny are always wrong, democracy and freedom right. Yes, as my wife never ceases to remind me, episodes are often dated, sentimental and naive. But frankly, I prefer that to the current cynicism and negativity in popular culture. Serling wrote in the democratic tradition of Dickens, Twain and O. Henry, which meant that the Twilight Zone is a place where we meet everyday people. For all their quirks and failings, they are attractive enough for us to believe in their capacity to overcome problems. And that is the philosophical path the Twilight Zone helped set me upon. Pessimism, be it of the old Cold War or current green type, needs to be replaced by optimism and courage. People are the solution, not the problem. Lesson to be learned, not just in the Twilight Zone, but from life itself.
Barry York with today's perspective.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.